everybody. You are listening to You, Me, Them, Everybody. My name is Brandon Weatherby, and sitting with me is someone that I've known for a very long time, and he's probably the cleanest cut zinester I've ever met, Andrew Mall. Say hello, Andrew.
Hello. This clean cut look is new, by the way.
No. I mean, in terms of you've never. I mean, okay. Let's go through it. Let's start from the beginning, which is usually a good place to start. I met Andrew, the guy I'm pointing to right now that no one else can see. What, 5 years ago, 6 years ago?
Yeah, 5 or 6 years ago sounds about right.
5 or 6 years ago, and he does this scene called Living Proof.
That's correct.
Okay, good. Because sometimes I mix it up with Proof I Exist, which is our friend Billy.
Yeah, I'm not Billy.
Exactly. Andrew has never smelled bad in front of me.
That's correct.
Unless it's like after a physical activity.
I don't do physical activities.
Okay, he knows how to use deodorant.
Yep.
Your zine was legible.
It's
probably the most professional looking zine there is.
I worked real hard on designing it. Absolutely.
Not cut and paste.
Nope.
And the stories didn't involve, like, fucking the man. It could have been about fucking the man, but it wasn't like, fuck you, man. It was more like, oh, I'm going to do this intellectually.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It was more subtle and nuanced than just straight up aggression.
And the fact that he said the word nuanced makes you realize that he's not your typical zinester. So, how did you get started in writing zines? Let's start there. Cause I don't think you're doing it anymore. Are you?
Kind of not actively. The latest issue, which will probably be the last issue, has been on the back burner for almost 2 full years.
I could relate.
How did I get started? I mean, I started off, writing a blog in like 2000.
So you were like the first few blogs.
I was among the first few bloggers. And in my kind of blog circle was this guy named Jack Saturn, who worked.
Hold on. What's his name?
Saturn. Jack Saturn. Like,
is
planet.
That his actual name?
Saturn.org was his website. I don't know if it still exists.
Is that his actual name, or is that just like a?
I don't know. I assume it's his actual. I don't. I've never actually spoken with him.
Okay, so it's a real blog situation.
Yeah. So, and he had a zine at the time, which I'm forgetting the name of right now. I've got a few issues at home. Anyway, there was a circle of people. Jack Saturn worked at the company that invented Blogger before it was sold to whoever bought it. Yahoo.
Really?
Or someone like that. Yeah.
Okay.
The guy who invented it, was his first name was Ev or Evan. So Jack worked for Ev. And I started reading the blogs and then started kind of writing my own in the fall of 2000. And that went on for about 2.5 years, pretty much right until I moved away from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, where I had gone to school, to Chicago, for where I started a master's program and kind of became an adult, as it were.
So you moved to Chicago, what, 6 years ago now? Seven?
7 years ago.
And you did that for school?
I did that initially for a master's program, yeah. It was a one-year master's degree.
Where was your master's at?
That was at the University of Chicago.
And what is that called?
It was called the one-year Master's of Arts program in the social sciences.
Okay, they still have that.
They still have that.
And that's the kind of program where you kind of make up what you pitch a curriculum and they say okay.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
What was yours?
So, I mean, I came in thinking I was going to do something about sociology of technology because I had been writing blogs and I was like, oh, this is really interesting. It's changing how people think about their lives. And then I decided I really didn't like doing that around the same time that I started taking a world music class in the first quarter that I was there. I learned about a field called ethnomusicology, and we can go into what that means in a minute. I discovered ethnomusicology, decided I wanted to be an ethnomusicologist. What that means, again, we'll talk about shortly. And ended up writing an 80-page master's thesis on indie rock.
Which, didn't that become one of your zines, or part of it?
Part of it went into one of the zines that I think the last issue that I did on Raina Maria. I'm not very sure.
That's the one where you interviewed Dan Sinker.
So I interviewed Dan Sinker. Oh yeah. So the Dan Sinker interview ended up in one of the issues of the zine. And I just had a lot of fun interviewing lots of different people in the indie rock scene here in Chicago. I got to know Elizabeth Elmore, who became a friend of mine, got to know the people who run Polyvinyl Records, and they became acquaintances of mine. I still talk to them every now and then, that type of thing.
For those of you that don't know, Elizabeth Elmore was in the bands
Sarge and then The Reputation.
Okay.
And now she's an attorney.
Yeah, she is an attorney. It's very odd to see her as an attorney at a bar at like 4 a.m. doing like attorney
she's
work.
Doing attorney stuff.
It's crazy.
At the bar. Yeah.
Yeah, she's really responsible. By the way, I'd just like to point out that you're the first guest to tease your own interview. the future parts of your own interview.
It's foreshadowing. It's a literary device, which you'll learn in your creative writing program.
No, I'm good. Fuck that. Okay, so describe ethnomusicology. You've teased it. Let's get into it.
Okay, so ethnomusicology is most easily described as the anthropology of music.
Okay.
It's basically the study of music in or as a part of culture. And so the things that ethnomusicologists typically look at are, how does music structure culture? How does culture structure music? How are kind of different ideas and powers and circumstances and distinctions within society are mirrored back in the way that music is produced, performed, and kind of ritualized? Traditionally, ethnomusicologists looked at music of the non-Western world, anything that wasn't Western art music or classical music.
But you don't do that.
I don't do that. So in the last maybe two or three decades, ethnomusicology has experienced kind of a shift where we take, where the discipline is using the methodologies that were developed to explore non-Western musics and are applying them to popular musics, both of the non-Western world and of the Western world. And also using that to apply to folk music of the Western world and art music of the Western world, too. So whereas before, ethnomusicologists would always be pigeonholed as people who study world music, and now they can study any type of music, and they're not
really...
What
do you prefer to study?
When people ask me at academic conferences, I tell them I'm a North Americanist, which means I
prefer... Indie rock.
Well, it's not just indie rock, but it's jazz, too. And it's
really? I didn't know you studied jazz.
I don't actively, but I can study jazz.
Okay, but no. What do you actually study?
I study rock. I study rock. That's what I tell people.
When you say rock, do you mean Bad Company, or do you mean...
I can talk about Bad Company if we need to.
Okay, what's the most recent, scene? Because you don't study individual bands, you study scenes.
Yeah, I study scenes. I'm into communities, into scenes. Okay. If I studied individual bands, I'd be doing like a biography or something, which mm-hmm. is something that journalists are trained for, but I'm not.
Okay. So what's a good scene that you've studied?
I mean, the scene that I'm building my dissertation on, which I don't even know if you know this, is the...
I don't think I do.
The underground Christian rock scene.
I didn't know that. This is very interesting.
Yeah. So,
how did you get involved in that?
My sister was heavily involved in Christian rock, in the Christian rock scene when she was in high school. And at the time, I thought it was really strange. She was like, Christian punk. And I was like, that doesn't make sense.
Let's trace this back further because it needs more explanation. You grew up where?
I grew up in New Jersey, in North Jersey.
When did you move to Bethlehem? That was for college, correct?
Moved to Bethlehem for college after graduate high school in 1997.
Okay, so you and your sister are how close in age?
So I'm the oldest of four. She's the youngest of four. We're 8 years apart.
So you were already like out of college when she got into this kind of?
Yeah, I was pretty much like I had moved back to Chicago for the master's program when she was in high school.
Okay, so you weren't like in her room like saying, what the fuck are you listening to? You just heard this through channels.
Yeah, I heard this. Well, I mean, we're a pretty close family, so we hang out and we chat and stuff like that.
Okay.
So,
well, are your parents religious?
My dad is a pastor. My mom is a daughter of Southern Baptist missionaries. But
were you raised religious?
I was raised religious.
Would you consider yourself religious now?
No.
Okay. Your sister, your youngest sister, was she raised religious or as religious as you were?
So we were all raised religious. I mean, we were a church going
same.
Yeah, we were a church going family. My parents still go to church. My dad preaches at a church. And you know, if to talk about my family, you know, the best way to say it is that my brother and I, the faith didn't necessarily stick. With my two sisters, who are then the younger two, the faith stuck a bit more, and they definitely kept going to church, and they still kind of go to church regularly.
Okay, how old is your sister now?
Oh, boy.
She's in her early 20s, yes?
Yeah,
okay.
She's in her early 20s.
Does she still listen to this music?
Not so much as she used to. She's kind of, I mean, we all grow in and out of scenes, and she's kind of grown out of that scene because she's gone through different phases.
But she's still a Christian.
I think she would still say she's a Christian. I actually have never touched upon that specific topic.
I'm very interested in this. So how does your sister studying it influence you to continue to study it?
So she wasn't actually studying it.
She was in it.
She was going to shows and like she was going on road trips. These bands, you know, they weren't necessarily coming through Chicago, but they were hitting the suburbs and kind of more rural areas. And she was driving out to Indiana and Michigan to see them. And
this is from Pennsylvania.
No, this is from
Jersey.
This is from Northern Illinois.
How did we get to Northern Illinois?
Okay, we missed that part.
Yeah.
When I was in college, halfway through my freshman year of college, my parents moved from New Jersey to Northern Illinois.
Okay, so she's like going to like the Cornerstone Festival and things like that.
So she went to Cornerstone once, and she was also participating in a youth coffee shop called Sold Out in the North Suburbs. I'm not sure what
okay.
Northern Suburb it was.
Did she ever play?
No.
Did you ever play?
Not in the Christian scene.
But have you played? You've played in like a band.
I had a band when I was in high school, and I you know, jammed, quote unquote.
I mentioned this because you did a reading about it.
Yeah,
I still
you know, I have the guitar sits out and I pick it up every now and then, but I'm not playing with anyone right now, and I haven't played with anyone for ages.
So you wouldn't consider yourself a musician?
Not. That's not my primary, you know, mode of expressing myself now.
What's your primary mode of expressing yourself?
Probably
now?
Writing.
Writing what?
I used to be able to say zines, but I don't really do that so much anymore. So now it's the academic stuff that I work on.
Do you think you're not doing the zine thing because you're too busy with the academic work, or just because you're older, or because the technology, because zines are being replaced by blogs?
It's not because zines are being replaced by blogs, because I started with a blog and then I gravitated towards a zine. So that argument, while I think it works for a lot of people, it doesn't work for me. It's easy to say that my work as an academic has kind of taken up more time than I can afford to, so I can't give more time to zines.
Mm-hmm.
But I still have a fair amount of free time that I devote to drinking booze and going to concerts and so on. So, you know, I think it's more along the lines of, you know, I spend so much time staring at the computer screen and writing stuff and grading that when I do have free time, kind of the last thing I want to do is write a piece again.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, let's get back to the Christian rock scene. Sorry about this. You say you're studying it. What does that entail?
So what does that entail from the ethnomusicology side is we do what's called participant observation, which is basically going into the community or going into the scene and just learning what it's about by being a part of it instead of just asking people.
Are you undercover? Or are you blatant about
The ethics dictate that you don't do it undercover. So it's not like, you know, maybe a journalist might go in undercover to kind of get the real story. Mm-hmm. And that's not really what ethnomusicologists are interested in normally, because we want to be honest with the people that we're studying. A lot of times they end up becoming our friends, so on and so forth.
Are you friends with anybody from the Christian rock scene you've been studying?
I have to be honest and say that I've just started studying and so I don't have too many. I haven't become friendly with the people that I've met yet. So I could very well have friends
in the future. How do you start studying it?
You know what? The way it turns out is the more people I talked about this, the more I find out that everyone knows someone who's a part of this scene. And it's a scene that it's totally, you know, it's underground in the best sense, and that it's totally there and you don't hear about it until you actually start asking about it. And it turns out like everyone knows someone. Like Aaron Sinek went to Cornerstone, and all the people I know that work at labels know people that have been in Christian bands. A friend of mine who's an editor at Downbeat, has one of his graphic designers used to be in a Christian band. Like all this stuff. It's crazy.
Why do you think we don't hear about it more?
I really don't know that yet.
I think you should find out, obviously. This is very interesting and creepy at the same time, that there's like this entire scene that everyone knows somebody that no one talks about.
Yeah, I'm not sure how creepy it is. It's interesting.
It's frightening
for sure.
To me, sir. Do you like any of the music?
Okay, so I went to Cornerstone this year, 2 weeks ago, and some of those bands are...
Let's explain Cornerstone for the people that don't know.
All right, Cornerstone is essentially the Coachella or the Bonnaroo of Christian rock.
It's in Illinois, is that correct?
Yeah, it's between Macomb and Peoria, out in western Illinois, south of the Quad Cities.
Okay, and it's big.
And it's huge. There are like 25,000 people there.
Is it 3 days?
It's 4 days, but you can camp there for an entire week if you want to.
Did you camp there?
No, I stayed in the dorms at Western Illinois University.
So is it on campus of Western?
No, it's not. It's in the huge, like, 125-acre farm outside of a town called Bushnell.
How much is it?
It's on a sliding scale, but, like, I bought a ticket the last possible minute. It was, like, $135.
For all 4 days?
For all 4 days,
So it's not crazy expensive,
no,
but
it's
not,
crazy
like...
expensive.
Okay.
It's cheaper than Lollapalooza.
Yeah, but everything is.
Yeah.
So, I don't know what that was about. The end. Okay. Who did you see that anyone would know?
Who did I see that anyone would know? There's this band, Me Without You, that I think people have heard of.
They're a Christian band?
Yeah.
Okay, see, that's the thing. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I've heard rumors like it's a bad thing.
Well, I went to see them in Metro like the day after I got back, and they were singing songs about how much they love Jesus. And as I was walking out of the Metro, guys were like, "Oh, dude, I'm totally moshing for Jesus." And they were like...
Wasn't an ironic, "Oh, dude, I'm totally moshing for Jesus"?
I think it kind of was ironic. Anymore? Yeah, I think it was kind of ironic to a certain degree. Like, there are people who just didn't know, and then they're like, "Oh, yeah, I guess it's Jesus rock."
Well, I mean, like, Nirvana does Jesus, just that old song. And people...
Yeah, but that's the Vaselines, right? And it's not really...
But it's still... So what? Well, Nutrimilk Hotel. I mean, is that a Christian rock
band? Well, you can sing about God, and you can sing about Jesus without being sincere about it. I mean, that happens a lot. You can sing about your
well, of course, of course.
You can sing about, you know, whether you think of yourself as an atheist or what's the term where you are searching for
agnostic?
God? Agnostic. A lot of these songs, a lot of these pop songs or blues, or maybe not blues songs, a lot of pop songs you might categorize as being from the more agnostic realm.
Oh, of course,
things.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, Johnny Cash, there's only three songs, and one of their subject matters is God, so
right.
You're going to... Well, who besides Me Without You? That's a well-known band.
Under Oath. They're
huge.
The
Christian metal,
and they're on
crap.
Warped right now.
Yeah, they're awful.
Reliant K was on Warped last year.
I didn't know they were a Christian band. I'm learning
I guess
somewhat.
They are. You know, they.
Do you think they are, or do you think that like there's a lot of people here, and they seem to be money here?
Reliant, there were a bunch of bands that I could tell and that other people that I spoke to at Cornerstone could also tell that these bands are like, oh, hey, I'm at Cornerstone. I better talk about Jesus or I better talk about Christianity. And then there are other bands who it felt a little bit more sincere. And I would say that Reliant K came off to me as more sincere. And a lot of bands, for the most part, do come off as more sincere. But the people that I talked to that I interviewed at Cornerstone, they're just like normal everyday people that came. They're like, oh, yeah, we can totally tell when a band isn't being sincere. And that really rubs us the wrong way, whether or not those people, those audience members are Christians.
Do you think the majority of the crowd is Christian, or do you think it's just more of a summer festival thing?
I think the majority of the crowd is Christian. Like, what percentage, I couldn't tell you. It's maybe around 70%. It's not like all Christian. I mean, I definitely talked to people who aren't regular churchgoers and mm-hmm. wouldn't say they were Christian.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you think that you're going to enjoy studying this?
I think so. And the reason why I say this is because what I learned at Cornerstone is that the music doesn't suck. Like, some of these bands are really, really good. Mm-hmm. Most of the bands at Cornerstone are real heavy. There's a lot of grindcore, a lot of hardcore,
really?
A lot of metalcore.
This is also the place where Dashboard Confessional played their first show, like, 10 years ago.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, like one of the side stages. This is when... What band was he in first? Chris Carabarabaraba?
Down in Florida.
Yeah, they're still playing. They have had, like, three different lead singers. Yeah, anyways, this is, he found Jesus, and then he played this first Dashboard show at Cornerstone, like a side stage.
And there are tons of side stages, so
exactly.
That I believe.
That's how I've always thought of Cornerstone, because I've never been. Do you think you're... Well, you don't have to answer this if you feel uncomfortable. Are you religious at all?
I don't think of myself as religious, no.
Do you believe in God?
I can't say that I believe in God 100%. If I had to categorize myself, I'd say I'm agnostic.
Do you think this study might change that?
I don't know that I can predict that. I wouldn't be surprised if my perspective on spirituality changed. Mm-hmm. I would be surprised if I came out the other end having this huge, you know, conversion moment. I don't actually expect that.
Okay. Well, I liked how we skipped from you wanted to study ethnomusicology to exactly what you're doing now. So let's fill in some of the blanks here.
Okay.
When you went to grad school to study ethnomusicology, or you didn't go to study ethnomusicology, but once you figured out you wanted to study ethnomusicology, what about it drew you to it? What was the impetus to study other cultures instead of, say, work on something of, like, just creatively?
Well, someone asked me this the other day, and I kind of had a chance to really give a lot of thought to it. When I was growing up, I was definitely big into playing music and to listening to music. Mm-hmm. You know, I studied saxophone, I learned how to play guitar, but I was also, you know, huge into lots of other things. And I was definitely the type of kid who felt attracted to doing so many different types of things and kind of felt a natural gift or talent towards doing so many things that I never cultivated a single talent. So I never gave myself the time or the discipline to cultivate myself as a musician. At one point I was like, you know, one point when I was in high school, I was like, oh, you know, I wonder what it would be like to be a professional musician. Oh, you know, I'll never have the time or the discipline to actually get to that level. I still studied music in college. I have a bachelor's of arts degree in college. I played saxophone all the way through. I did a composition degree. I never thought I would go anywhere further with that. You know, I was a computer science major at the time. But then when I got to the master's program, I realized and I learned, and I just hadn't been aware of this, that you can, or that I could, have a future that has something to do with music without necessarily being a performer or without being involved directly in the industry, in the business of music. And that's what really kind of attracted me to it. The idea that you can be a part of music and talk to people about music and write about music and not necessarily have be creative as far as being a musician is concerned or being business-minded as far as being in the industry is concerned.
And you made this decision like roughly right when I met you.
Yeah, right around the time we met. Probably. I mean, you and I met after I finished the first zine, which was following that year.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a young man's game, a lot of it.
Yeah.
Do you find yourself happy with this decision?
At this stage, yeah, for sure. And, you know, back then, I always would keep going back. It's like, oh, maybe I should just put down the keyboard and pick up the guitar again, the computer keyboard and pick up the guitar again. But again, it's like, you know, once you get into the cycle of having to find a full-time job and pay rent and bills and groceries and all that stuff, it's like, you know, I'm not the young person who can live on basically nothing while perfecting my craft.
Of course.
I just, you know, by the time I finished grad school, I was, you know, what, 25, 24, something like that.
That's very young for finishing grad school.
Yeah, it's still relatively young, but it's, you know, I just, the life of, you know, the aesthetic life required of someone who's trying to make a performance career happen wasn't very attractive to me at the time.
Okay. Well, you're still in school.
Yeah, I'm still in school.
And this is for what?
I've just finished my fourth year in the PhD program in ethnomusicology at the University of Chicago.
How many more years do you have in this?
I hope to only have two more years, a year of doing the research and then a year of writing the actual dissertation.
How long is the dissertation?
250 pages, more or less. It depends.
Do you think you're going to get fed up and try to do, instead of Christian rock, do something that's more familiar to you?
No.
Okay.
I don't have the time to switch topics.
Okay, that's fair.
That's just not going to happen.
So you graduate with a PhD in 2 years, then what?
Then I hope to get a full-time job teaching at a university.
Okay, but you're kind of doing that now.
So I'm teaching a full-time load right now, yeah. Last year, last academic year, and this upcoming academic
year.
What
kind of classes are you teaching?
So there's a class that I've taught a few years running that's basically a class that introduces freshmen to the resources of the university where I teach and the resources of the city of Chicago through Chicago's musical life.
Okay.
It's, you know, the students are learning about the Chicago music scene, essentially. I've done that for 3 years running. This next year will be my fourth year doing that class.
So where do you take them?
We've gone to the Jazz Fest. We've toured the Metro and Symphony Center. We've gone to shows. We've gone to CSO concerts. We've toured Lyric Opera. We've gone up to Ravinia every year. I've taken them to punk clubs. I've taken them to the Beat Kitchen. I took them to Reggie's last year. They hated it.
Which one do they hate, Beat Kitchen or Reggie's?
They hated Reggie's. They hated Beat Kitchen too, actually. These kids always hate the punk clubs for some reason.
What kind of kid? You would imagine that it'd be like the hipsters that are enroll in this class.
Yeah, well, so the hipsters, the year we went to the Beat Kitchen, the hipsters absolutely loved it. It was Flatfoot 56, a Southside, you know, punk band.
But usually hipsters don't like that.
Well, the hipster punk suburbanite kids loved
it. Okay, yeah.
They loved it. And but from last year on, this class is only for music majors.
Oh, when did that did the university decide that?
Yeah, the university decided that.
That makes a lot more sense.
And so, you know, the music majors, they're all classical or jazz performance majors.
They know how to like read music.
Yeah, and so
et cetera.
And a lot of them just haven't had too much exposure to loud rock and roll clubs. Since the smoking ban went into effect, it's a lot easier to take them to these clubs because they're not complaining about having to, you know, walk through cigarettes the whole time.
That is so funny to me.
Yeah, it's kind of funny to me too, but that's...
So that's one of the classes you teach.
One of the classes I teach. Another class I teach it's basically a history of punk class.
Okay, what is it? See, this is the problem with Andrew.
There's a problem.
There's a huge problem with you, sir. Andrew is really smart, and everyone knows Andrew's smart. And then you're like, what do you do for your job? And you hear something like this, and you just want to beat the shit out of him because you think you know more about the subject matter than him. So rather than making this a pissing contest, I will try to be as polite as possible.
Sure.
And what do you teach in punk rock class? I can't believe that you teach punk rock. This is absurd. Okay.
I'm the professor of punk.
Son of a bitch. This is bullshit. All right, continue. So what do you teach in this class?
The punk class is basically, it traces punk rock from the New York scene in the art world.
So you start, already I have like, argh, where do you start the scene?
We start the scene with like the New York Dolls and Patti Smith and Television. Okay. But we look backwards to Velvet Underground and talk about the kind of that stuff too.
For those of you that don't know, I put my hand by my penis and did a fuck you that I'm whacking off motion because that's bullshit to me. Continue though, I'm sorry.
And then we go forward, you know, with the Ramones and the kind of CBGB scene. We jump across the pond and talk about the Sex Pistols, the Clash. It stops being a litany of band names really by the time we get through the 70s. And I actually look at the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. And by the time we get past the 70s, we're talking about different subgenres of punk. And so one of my goals in the punk class is to get the students to think about, okay, what does punk mean, or what has it meant? And how has that definition kind of changed and morphed over time? What has been constant? What has changed? And so if we look at all those different elements and we look at subgenres that claim to be of the lineage of punk, mm-hmm. that allows the students to kind of say, okay, well, here's where I can see that working. Here's where I don't see that working. You know, these people sound like they're playing punk, but they don't really have any of the ideals. They don't bring the DIY aesthetic to it. You know, they don't.
I'm guessing you're talking about like Talking Heads right now and stuff like that.
Yeah, but even if we go forward and we talk about, you know, the pop punk scene and the Warped Tour Epitaph Records and
I'm
all that stuff.
I'm still thinking of like late 70s.
Yeah, but we actually don't really talk about Talking Heads all that much because I do try and move us through the 70s and the 80s really quickly.
This is like a 10-week course too, so you don't have a lot of time.
Yeah, it's very fast.
Yeah. What are your texts?
I don't use a textbook, so they have maybe 3 readings every day, and there are 2 days a week.
These are like just magazine articles.
So some of them are magazine articles, some of them are zine articles, some of them are interviews, some of them are newspaper articles. A lot of them are biographies or oral histories. We've got some documentaries.
What are the oral histories?
Please Kill Me,
that's
an oral
the
history
best.
Of
yes,
punk.
That's great.
So we talk about the UK scene. There's one on the LA scene called, I want to say it's Louder Than Bombs, but I know that's not it. Because
is that the one that they also made into a documentary like 3 years ago?
Oh, that's American Hardcore. Yeah. We read from that too. And we actually watched the American Hardcore documentary as well.
Did you get to make this curriculum?
So this was a course that I proposed and I wrote up the whole thing. So this is my first self-designed course ever. Yeah.
That is great.
Yeah, it was awesome.
You really get to do it like every 16-year-old with a big head thinks they can do.
Well, I mean, it's not just every 16-year-old. Every grad student wants the opportunity to design her or his own course.
That's amazing.
And the fact that I've been able to do this before I've even graduated is kind of great experience for me.
Well, do you like punk music?
You know what? Teaching it has actually made me go back to it and listen to the records more and kind of really figure out what it is these artists were doing so that I can sound like I know what I'm talking about when the students are discussing it.
Well, who was somebody that before you started the class you were like really, really into and now you're just kind of eh, and vice versa?
I would say that I was a huge Television fan and still I started learning how much of a dick Tom Verlaine is. Turns out the guy was a massive asshole.
Okay. What is it that shocked you?
I guess I never really gave too much thought about the context in which that music was made. You know, now that I go back and listen to like these crazy 8-minute guitar winking songs, it's like, yeah, this has to be the product of someone who thinks much too highly of himself. So that's an example of a band that I really, really dug. And then kind of learning more about the context made me appreciate it slightly less.
Okay.
A band that I was never hugely into was Black Flag. Now, I knew so many Black Flag fans, and I still know lots of Black Flag fans, but I just never really got it. And now that I've actually gone through and listened to almost all the records in depth and really kind of read not just Henry Rollins' take, but the take of everyone who's been involved with the band, Kira and Greg and the guy that did all the artwork for them. Mm-hmm. I forget his name right now. But to read about, you know, what they went through and also to watch that documentary and kind of see how what they were doing down in Southern California was kind of really influencing everything that was going around the states in the next 4 or 5 years, like, that made me really appreciate them a lot more.
Okay. One last question about the punk class.
Sure.
Why not start with Iggy and MC5?
Because I just don't have enough time. In a 14-week course at a school that's on a semester calendar, I would definitely go back further, for sure.
It's just a shame.
I would.
It's just a shame. And then you can do Bo Diddley.
Yeah. There are a lot of ways, and you know, in one sense, starting it in, you know, early 70s is kind of a cop out. It's all artificial.
But you kind of have to. I mean, you're right. I mean, hell, if anything, this you can do 1 year is one quarter.
I mean, the thing is a lot of these students in their feedback, like, oh, I thought punk started with the Ramones, or I thought punk started with the Sex Pistols, and just the fact that Patti Smith was playing and recording in 1973 and 74 blew their minds.
To be fair to the students, I would agree with a lot of them technically the term punk, remember, like, punk, if you're going to do a punk zine, mm-hmm. then yes, the Ramones were on the first cover, therefore
right.
that makes sense. So,
but Lester Bangs and the people of Cream magazine were referring to garage rock of the late 60s mm-hmm. as punk.
Of course.
By then, before then.
But but we can both agree that it wasn't as commercialized.
No, it wasn't commercialized.
So it makes
at all.
Sense. I'm surprised that the kids aren't like Rancid started punk or something. Like, that would be absurd.
Yeah.
Which you might get into it the longer you teach this class.
Well, so. I don't know. Maybe. I haven't had any kids say, oh, you know, punk started in the 90s. I think they're all aware. They've all heard of the Sex Pistols and they've all heard of the Clash. And that might be, for many of them, where their personal history of punk starts. So at the very least, I get them to extend that history back, you know, 5 years.
Oh, and that's great.
Yeah.
Do you like teaching or do you like the... Because, I mean, the field research is probably a lot different than the teaching of the class. What do you prefer?
I don't know that I prefer necessarily one or the other. I like doing both. For a lot of academics, teaching is kind of a necessary evil. You know, they look at it as a way to kind of earn the paycheck so they can then go out and do their work. I actually really enjoy working with the students. The more I teach, I've been telling people this, the more I teach part-time, the more I really want to teach full-time and have a reason to be invested in these students' academic careers.
For to make it clear, these are all undergrads, correct?
These are all undergrads,
and they're mostly what year?
These are mostly first and second years.
Okay, so they're just out of high school.
Yeah, they're 18, 19, 20 years old.
Do you think it's easier to connect to these students because you did zines and because you were involved in music?
I wouldn't say that the zines, the whole zine thing makes it easier for me to connect to these students because many of them don't actually know what zines are.
Yeah.
So the idea that I, you know, wrote zines, I think is kind of foreign to them. And it's not something that I actually recall bringing up in class or bring up in class directly. The fact that I was involved in youth music real heavily or in youth oriented music scenes real heavily from, you know, middle school until the present day, makes, I think to me, gives me a way in which I can connect with them. Now, the fact remains that they hear so much other music that I don't hear. You know, they're all over MySpace and these kids are, they're a little bit more in tune to, you know, hype and so on. Whereas me, I kind of feel almost like an older fuddy-duddy type of person who doesn't really know what's going on in the music scene. So that makes me feel old. But that doesn't mean that I can't appreciate the type of music that they want to bring in and talk about.
Well, I mean, you're older in a different sense because, sorry, you do find out about new music because of your current, like, volunteer work.
And I obviously you want to move into talking about that
just
a little bit. I'll say that since I stopped working at WLUW full time 2 years ago, my exposure to new music has definitely dropped off.
Do you think that's hurting you in for your professional career? Does it matter?
I don't think it matters.
Okay.
Yeah.
Last question, but it might take a very long time besides the book. What do you listen to? What did you listen to when you were in high school? What did you listen to when you thought you were when you were studying music? What did you listen to when you were just starting ethnomusicology? And what do you listen to now?
When I was in high school, I listened to a lot of local hardcore.
Local being?
North Jersey.
Okay.
Local hardcore, local punk. So, like, Lifetime was huge back then. Pop punk, Weston was real big back then. People might have heard of Weston. They might not have. And you know, bands that came out of that scene, like Thursday came out of that scene after listening to Lifetime as those guys were growing up, as Jeff and those guys were growing up. Bands like that kind of came out of the scene, the same scene that I was participating in the 90s. In college, I definitely listened to a lot of like third wave emo and indie rock of the late 90s and early 2000s.
Give me some band names for people.
When I say third wave emo, I'm thinking of bands like The Promise Ring and The Get Up Kids and Braid and Raina Maria, that kind of, you know, class of 98, 99 stuff. And then, you know, Modest Mouse and Built to Spill and Pavement, those were all like Modest Mouse is just coming up and Built to Spill and Pavement were kind of, in the middle of their careers while Pavement's kind of dropping off and Built to Spill is kind of still going on, okay, trudging along.
they're playing tomorrow or this weekend.
It's Friday. They're playing. What's today? Wednesday. Okay.
And it's Wednesday where this is going up Thursday, like tonight, late. So
okay.
Thursday, essentially.
And when I was in college, I was definitely one of those elitist indie rock snobs that everyone hates, that I hate now. I seen a lot of the kids that I teach too.
Did you ever try to pick up a girl with like knowledge of a band at a jukebox?
I'm probably sure that I did. I can't think of any specific.
I used to watch that whenever I was a doorman, and I would just boil with anger.
Yeah, it's really, I can't imagine being the woman trying to be picked up, or that would be really annoying.
That would be wooed by that too. It was amazing.
I mean, I definitely had a crutch on my shoulder kind of against anyone who I felt had inferior taste, which meant anyone who didn't listen to the music that I listened to. And like indie rock still breeds that type of elitism.
Definitely.
And that's super, super annoying. Things have changed a little bit in that the types of genres that people listen to in that scene have broadened.
Definitely. If you look at
the history of the types of bands that, for example, Pitchfork has covered over the last decade, there's been a huge shift, and there's, you know, they still look at like really kind of underground indie bands that no one's ever heard of, but they're also all over the mainstream, and they also do a lot of kind of dance and pop and stuff like that too. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a kind of a good barometer of how the scene has developed over the last over the period that I've been.
So you were a snob when you were in undergrad?
Yeah, when I was in undergrad, for sure.
You're going to grad school and you're getting your first master's or whatever. It's your first master's?
Yeah, it was a master's degree. Technically, it's my second. It was my second master's.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
Fuck you then. Okay, so what are you listening to then?
So at that point, I was probably still listening to a lot of indie rock and just starting to appreciate the fact that genres that weren't indie rock also had value.
So I
started listening, and I still listen to a lot of classic rock at the time. I never really listened to a lot of chart pop or top 40 stuff, but I finally came around to the idea that people who like that stuff have a legitimate taste, and whether or not that taste is something that I have is kind of irrelevant to that at this point.
Well, what do you listen to now?
I mean, it's easy to say that I listen to a lot of noise rock, but that's false because I don't actually like go out and search stuff. I mean, I listen to basically stuff that people give me.
Like what this last week, the last 7 days, who do you remember listening to on your iPod or whatever?
Yeah, I don't know.
Neither do I. That's why
I mean, Built a Spill came up on the iPod earlier today, and that kind
of... Did you skip it?
No, I did not skip it. There were like two Pavement tracks in a row. So, I mean, my iPod is full of the stuff that I listened to in the late 90s.
Okay.
And that's the stuff that still kind of strikes home to me, and that would be my classic rock when I'm 40 or 50
years
old.
That makes sense.
And I'm fine with that.
you said it with such resignation.
No, and I'm going to the Pitchfork Festival this year.
Are you working in or actually going to see bands?
I mean, I'm volunteering there with Chirp, with the Chicago Independent Radio Project, but I'm there the whole day, all 3 days, to see bands too, and I've only heard of maybe a third of the bands, and so I'm kind of excited to see whether any of the other bands I haven't heard of are pretty good. I will say I'm excited to see Frightened Rabbit. I actually have tickets to their after party on Sunday, but you know what else I have tickets to? Sunny Day Real Estate. I'm going to see that in September. So it's like, you know, it's hard to say that I listen to new music, because even the new music I listen to is still very reminiscent of the older stuff that I listen to. Frightened Rabbit is very can be a lot like Elliott Smith and that type of singer-songwriter stuff at times.
So you know exactly where you stand. You're okay with it.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. And no longer does it bother me that people have other tastes. I don't really...
Well, that's very kind of you. You gave people the option. Well, let's close this with a question from the Kids Book of Questions by Gregory Stockpeet. What, you were going to say something?
I was going to say that I've been listening to your podcast, and one question that I had for a while was whether or not you mark off which questions people choose.
Nope.
Yeah, I learned that because there were two podcasts in a row where people chose the same question.
Did they really?
Yeah, it was like, I don't know, it was... probably a full dozen episodes ago, but
thanks
yeah.
for listening. That's very nice. I didn't think any of them repeated.
Yeah, there was one that you'll have to go back and check your
I will archives. Not do I'm not doing that. I think it'll be more interesting for the listener to go do that. So you have to pick between 1 and 260.
I'm thinking 212.
I like doing that.
Yeah, we can hear you flipping through the
that's
book.
That's right. It's fun. Okay. Ooh, this is good. This is a deep one.
Okay.
Seriously.
All right.
You don't have to answer. We can go to another one. Have you ever seen your mother or father cry? If not, how do you think it feel to see that?
I've definitely seen my mother cry. My dad is kind of, he's got this real stoicism to him, where he doesn't like you to see him weak. He's not like some big huge all-American dad, but you know, when he's not in a good mood, he goes and hides. My mom I've seen cry. Yeah, there have been kind of tensions in my parents' marriage that have kind of erupted into her emotions that I've been witness to. So yeah, it's a weird feeling to kind of see your parents, people that you look up to, at very vulnerable points in their life. But as I've grown older, I'm 31 years old now, is my parents are less my parents, and they are kind of friends and people that kind of help me figure out what to do with the rest of my life. So, you know, they've seen me vulnerable, I've seen them vulnerable, and I'm okay with that.
You answered that in a very deep way.
Thank you.
You're very honest. Thanks for doing this, man.
All right, thank you.
Do you want to plug anything? I don't know if you should.
I don't really have anything to plug. Yeah, I can mention, if you let me mention, the Chicago Independent Radio Project.
Why would I refuse?
CHIRP is the acronym, chirpradio.org, O-R-G, for more information. It's a new community-oriented radio broadcast. It's going live at the end of the summer as a web radio station, and we are petitioning and fighting to bring a new low-power FM station to the city of Chicago. There's really no timeline on that, but check chirpradio.org for the web broadcast when it goes live.
And Andrew and a few other people that I know, and probably Andrew knows too, are going to be doing a reading, which you haven't done since I think you got engaged.
Yeah, I haven't done a reading since February,
which was 21st. And I went to a reading at Quimby's to see Andrew, and I didn't know what was going to go on, and Andrew wouldn't tell me, and Billy wouldn't tell me, and Aaron wouldn't tell me, so I just sat there and got drunk alone on the floor
and took great pictures.
And I took photos of this, and I didn't realize what was going on. And Andrew was proposing.
It was a 20-minute proposal.
And I was drunk, alone on the floor, and I felt awful. Like, I got drunk! It sounds like I'm really sad, but I was, like, surrounded by friends, so I wasn't... I'm not trying to justify alcoholism. I'm trying to say it was delightful.
Yeah.
This reading will be nothing like that.
No, I'm already engaged. I don't need to do it again.
This is The Hungry Brain. It's going to be August 17th. It's going to be a free thing. All the money that is collected, though, will go to the readers. It's Andrew, Scott Smith, and a few more. So go to the You Me Them. Everybody check that out. I'm going to plug something else. I'm going to close this show with a song from Otter Petter. Otter Petter are playing July 31st at the Beat Kitchen. It's a 17 and over show. So for all of you underage kids out there, go over there and go steal some beer. That's a good Friday night show too. They're a really nice band, and they were kind enough to let me have one of their songs for the first You Me Them Everybody Chicago Music Podcast, which is a different feed that you can subscribe to. So that's why I'm plugging them. That's what you're gonna hear. I've talked to you much and need water, thanks to Andrew.
Yeah, your throat's real dry,
I know, isn't it? It's really bad. I didn't even smoke today. So have a wonderful evening.